This is the Bigfoot Information Project podcast. Hello, and welcome to the first ever Bigfoot Information Project podcast, what we're calling the BIPcast for short. First ever, and quite possibly last ever, depending on how well this one goes. We'll see. Since I'm a guy with a day job just like the rest of us, we'll have to see if the show turns out well enough to make it worth all of our whiles, both to make the show if you're me, and listen to the show if you're you. And just who am I anyway? Well, my name is Brian Brown, and I'm the founder of the Bigfoot Information Project. You can find the project online at bigfootproject.org, and I also started the Bigfoot Forums, found online at bigfootforums.com. If this goes as well as I hope it will, I'll be back with periodic podcast interviews of people I think are doing interesting and or notable research into those big hairy animals commonly referred to as Bigfoot. If you'd like to discuss what you're hearing on the BIPcast or make suggestions for future show topics, just surf on over to the Bigfoot Forums, where you'll find an entire section devoted to the Bigfoot Project. Look for the BIPcast conversations and just dive in. I'd love to hear what you think of this, what you like, what you don't like, and how you think I could be doing this better. My very first guest on the BIPcast is Kathy Moskowitz Strain. Kathy is the forest archaeologist for the Stanislaw National Forest in Sonora, California. Kathy has an MA in anthropology and has written and spoken widely regarding her interest in the traditional Native American stories of the Yokut people in Central California. These stories prominently feature a being called the Hairy Man, a Sasquatch-like figure rendered by the Yokuts in a pictograph found in a rock shelter on their reservation. My first question for Kathy asked her how she became aware of the Hairy Man pictograph in the first place.
When I started college, I went to Porterville Junior College, and the first class I took, in fact, was my anthropology class, and I can't remember if it was cultural or physical, but the professor there asked us the first day of class, you know, why are you here? Why are you in this class? And I said, well, I'm going to be an anthropologist, and I'm going to study Bigfoot. And she didn't laugh at me or anything. She just nodded her head, and then after class, she asked me if I knew about that pictograph that was up on the reservation, and I said no. And it was really weird because I knew lots of people up there and had gone to school with people, and nobody had ever mentioned it. And so probably within a few weeks or so, I talked to a friend who lived on the reservation, and I got a chance to go see it and came back and talked about it with her, and that's how I first found out about it.
So was it well known as something that may have suggested Bigfoot before you started doing your research into it? It sounds like it.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Everybody on the reservation called it the Hairy Man, acknowledged that it was Bigfoot. Huh. I mean, I knew that they had a belief in it. I didn't know there was pictographs there. And it's part of because it's, you know, it's a sacred thing to them. And so they didn't, you know, advertise, well, guess what, there's pictographs up there. But the anthropology community, very small as it was in Porterville, was well aware of it. And her name was Gay Weinberger. She's since passed on. She had written some papers about the cultural importance of Bigfoot to the Yokuts tribe and given it at a rock art conference, you know, back in the early 1980s.
Okay.
So it was well known.
I see. For the people who haven't had the pleasure of listening to your presentation, could you sort of give a brief rundown of how the Hairy Man, the role the Hairy Man plays in the Yokuts tribe?
Oh, sure. Well, Hairy Man is part of who created the Yokuts. So all the animals that were around at the time met into this cave, and we call it Painted Rock Cave, and they decided to create man, and every animal that was present gave a gift to man. So, you know, I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but, you know, condor gives them something, eagle gives them intelligence, and he gives them hunting. Well, Hairy Man wanted to give man the ability to walk on two legs, and Coyote wanted them to walk on all four. They challenged each other to a race coyote was going to cheat. Hairy Man knew that, so he stayed behind, and the rest of the animals created humans on 2 feet. And then they painted themselves on the cave so that man would always remember what the animals had done for them. And so if it wasn't for Hairy Man, we wouldn't be walking on 2 feet. And then he has just a lot of different other stories about just interactions and different behaviors that he has that the Yokuts have recorded over time. But today, he's still very, very important. They have a Hairy Man ceremony that has a traditional song that goes with it. And he, in spirit form, not in physical form, comes and gets people who the Yokuts who have just passed on and takes them over to the other side. And that's a very important role.
In a little while, I want to talk about that connection, that or try to have you explain the difference between the physical world and the spirit world for these people, because I know that that's something that's really interesting. But when did you know the white man? When did we first discover this cave and these pictographs? How long has this been known about?
It has been known. The reservation was established like in the late 1800s, and
okay.
The Yokuts asked specifically that they have wherever the reservation was placed. There was one originally, but it was too close to white people. And during the discussions of where to move it, they said, you know, Painted Cave is very important to us.
Okay.
Can we at least have the area around it? And that's it ended up how they got such a large area. And we have photographs of it from the late 1800s.
Right.
I have it in a book that's from 1880, and so it's been very well documented. And I think that's so much so because it's so huge. I mean, you just don't get rock art that's 8 feet tall. It's extremely rare. I mean, I know of two other times when that's happened where something is literally life size or greater. And the other one of them is actually on the reservation as well, and it's never been photographed. And so they're very, very rare to have something that's that big, that large, that colorful in one place.
How many tribes in California or in that part of the country use pictograph as a form of writing this stuff down?
California is well known for our pictographs.
Okay.
The oldest form of rock art is something called a cupule, which is a very, very small indent in a rock. So it looks like a divot that's in a golf ball, and you can have multiple hundreds and thousands of those on one rock, and it has meaning for whoever put that on there.
Okay.
Then you have petroglyphs, which are, you know, pecked into the rock. You're carving it into the rock, and it can be just basically very shallow to very deep. And then pictographs are the most recent in time because the ability for it to survive is less because you're using organic material in order to do that. So, but they're still in the range of 2,000 to 3,000 years old. And California has the best known pictographs anywhere in the United States. And the Chumash in particular on the coast are well known for their use of blues and yellows and unusual colors.
They're just not usually this big.
They're just not usually nowhere near this big.
Okay, I see.
Petroglyphs, not normally this size. So.
Okay. How many times have you been there? Have you seen it and talked to the Yokuts over the years?
Oh, many times. I used to be the district archaeologist for the districts that surrounded the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
So for the U.S. Forest Service, the reservation was right in between two U.S. Forest Service districts or land masses. And so I did the archaeology for the reservation because we just had a mutual agreement. So when they needed to build something, I would go over and I'd clear the land for them and write the report and get it done. And it was through that relationship of working with them like that, plus I excavated this large village site where the elders from the tribe would come and visit me and sit and talk for hours and hours while I was excavating. Or I'd go over there when they'd have, the elders in particular were real fond of me because I had a little baby. And I would go over there to their meetings to take the notes for them, and we'd have potlucks. And so, just hours and hours and hours of this. And then they just had never met anybody who, even though I'm part Native American myself, I'm obviously a white girl, they had never met somebody who actually truly believed that Bigfoot existed and wanted to hear what they had to say. And so it was through that they just said, I'm worried about my health. I'm worried that these stories aren't going to be passed on the way they need to be passed on. We're going to give them to you. And the only agreement that I had was for the gentleman who told me the majority of the stories, Isidore Garfield, is to wait until he passed on before I put anything in print.
I see.
That is why it took so long for me to actually verbally express it, because I was trying to uphold my agreement with him.
Do you know, I mean, is there any recordings or anything that would let us know if their stories have changed that much since we first heard them back in the 1800s, or have they stayed pretty consistent?
That's one of the things I've been looking for. There are original, I don't know now what you call them, but the original cylinder-type recordings, mm-hmm. the old-fashioned kind. There are those that exist. They're very hard to get to, and they're in the process of trying to get those all transcribed from the ethnographers. An ethnographer is somebody who came through and recorded everything that was about that tribe in the early, you know, 1850s and on, and not everything that they found out about that tribe is written down because, you know, it wasn't interesting or it wasn't important or whatever reason, and so, but they still exist in the original notes. And so I do have Bigfoot stories from mm-hmm. those types of notes, but I haven't found any. Well, I have a few that are Yokut, but not those particular stories that
okay.
I have found that are from the 1800s.
But it might be possible that there's an interview out there somewhere that has some of these stories on it that just hasn't been heard yet?
I would think so.
Okay.
I would think they're out there, but you have to find them. And plus, a lot of times, it just depends on who the tribe was. Sometimes they didn't feel entirely comfortable giving people they didn't know every bit of information that they had. You know, they gave things that they felt were safe. And the Bigfoot stories that I do have from tribes all through California and all through the United States, I don't think are all there are. I think those are just the ones they felt comfortable telling somebody about.
Why do you think, can you explain why they wouldn't feel comfortable? Why do they feel that these things are or some of these stories are stories that they won't share with outsiders?
Well, it's yesterday I was out at the tribal reservation here in Sonora, California, the Miwok, and they know me. They've known me for 8 years. They've told me all kinds of personal things, but the dances that they performed were safe dances in the sense of what they're willing to share on mm-hmm. with the outside. And it's just as if you were a religious person, you wouldn't necessarily, most people, start telling everything about what you believe and about your religious nature mm-hmm. right off the bat, because you don't know that person, you don't know what they're going to do with the information.
Sure.
And it's very deeply personal, and so it wouldn't surprise me. I'd be more surprised if those types of stories were more common than they are, because it would tell me that maybe they really didn't put much significance into it.
Right.
Because there are some that exist, and I know that there are deeper parts to it, that tells me that it did mean a lot to them. They were willing to share surface information, but anything like that spiritual nature that we'll talk about in a little bit wasn't shared because it was just too personal, it was too important, it was too cultural to who they were, and they'd already had so much taken from them, they weren't willing to let that go as
right.
well.
Okay. It's almost, you know, everything, like what you just said, everything else has been taken. They're left with very little land, relatively speaking, and so they're just holding on to these things as sort of their last.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's unfortunate because to some degree that's kind of bit them in the butt, because like the dance that we had yesterday, a lot of the elders who knew those dances have passed on, and
right.
it's not captured somewhere else, and so they're
right.
having to do the best that they can with what they know. And so there are ceremonies that aren't complete, because they don't know everything there
sure.
is to know. So, you know, that it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. How many other, are you aware of, how many other times do you see images that are like Sasquatch showing up in the stories or the artwork of Native Americans?
Well, story-wise, it's very, it's a lot easier to pick them out because they're always giants.
Right.
90% of the time they're covered with hair, you know,
right.
so those are really easy to pick out. But visually, it's not as easy to pick out because I get sent pictographs or petroglyphs from all over the United States, photographs of them, and say, oh, I think this is what it is. But it's very, very difficult to try to interpret somebody else's artwork without a cultural context
right.
in order to analyze it. So I need the tribe to tell me that's what they say that is, because it could be just a fat human. It could be a short,
right.
stubby human.
Right.
It's just a foot. Well, I don't know if that's a human foot or something else. It's very difficult to try to interpret somebody else's work. And so that's why I'm always very careful that the artwork that I present, like in the baskets, those were the photographer or whoever documented that back in the 1800s said, this is what that artist said it was. And I'm not interpreting that basket as being Hairy Man. The lady who was weaving it at the time said that's what it was.
I see.
And that's what I feel comfortable. I mean, I could say, well, that looks pretty suspicious to me, or that looks, but that's just my opinion. And that's like me trying to tell somebody what the Mona Lisa is supposed to be. I didn't paint it.
Yeah, what
the
is she
told me what it was.
What is she smiling about? I suppose we'll never know. Yeah.
No, we'll never know, because that wasn't, we weren't the one painting it. And so I'm sure the artist knows. And I'm sure when that person was doing that rock art, he may have intended it to be a Bigfoot. But, you know, hair doesn't come across so well necessarily.
Right.
And size, unless you got another obvious human next to it.
And even then, like you said, unless you have some sort of context, it could just be a big guy.
That's right.
Just
and
like,
so I tend not to try to interpret for other people what mm-hmm. it is. And what I'm hoping is that other people will get out there and ask the tribe, what is this? What do you think it is? And not lead them, not say, oh, I think it's a Bigfoot. What do you think? No, you let them tell you what it is. That's not our right to even do that much. You just go, well, what is it? And then have them tell you.
Do you find that the stories from the Yokuts are different than those of other Native Americans, or does the Hairy Man have a different role in their stories than compared to other tribes?
Yes, I feel that very much, that Hairy Man is, and the only tribe I haven't had much interaction with, and I'm trying to get some information for, is the Mono, and that's the tribe that exists between the Yokuts and the Miwoks that I'm living around right now. They may have a more similar belief to Yokuts, but he has such a significant role in their culture that without him, I think that they wouldn't be the tribe that they are. He is so significant to them versus the Miwok, the tribe that I'm around here. He was definitely not a good guy. He was completely an ogre. He did bad things. He occupied the caves, so much so that they stopped using caves. They wouldn't even put burials in there because he'd eat the dead. He was just a horrible being. There are no stories, and I have got like 20 stories of just Miwok, where he did anything other than torture people, steal their kids, steal their food, nothing whatsoever good about him. Versus the Yokuts, he had he wasn't necessarily the best guy when he was walking around in human in physical form, but when he's in spiritual form, he provides a whole lot of protection, a whole lot of spiritual guidance to the tribe. And the Mono, I think, probably have some of those beliefs, but I haven't been able to get that information out of them.
I see. So you've touched on it there. So let's get into it now. excuse me. I know that there's a lot of, I don't really understand how they make the distinction between these creatures in the real world versus the spiritual world. Can you try to explain to someone who hasn't gone to school to study it?
Oh.
What are we talking about when we're talking about creatures that live in the physical world versus the spiritual world for a Native American?
Okay. Well, it does vary from tribe to tribe, and so I'm just kind of giving you the California version
sure
of
thing.
It because it's not as studied with other cultures.
Okay.
All animals have a physical form, and all animals have a spiritual form. So it isn't just Hairy Man that has this ability. And in the physical form, they gave up being the rulers of the earth when humans were created, and that was the intent. They created us with the intent of having some power over the earth as long as we're, you know, we do the right thing. We weren't meant to crush anybody or anything like that, but we're the caretakers. And so the form that they're in now was the form that they chose themselves, and that's the form of, you know, a rat that scurries around and steals food and the blue jay that you know takes acorns and puts them in the ground and helps other acorn trees to grow, and that's what they're meant to be. And in those forms, they're just plain ordinary animals. And you, as a tribal member, you have a group of people, your family, that associates itself with a particular animal. So the bear clan or the mountain lion clan. And that animal then to you is very special. And so you don't ever eat that animal. You don't go hunt bear. You don't kill bear. And bear in return in its physical form won't do any harm to you. And so that's the kind of agreement they have going on. But whenever you kill any animal to eat it, you're always giving it a blessing or prayer. You're saying, thank you for giving your life to me.
Mm-hmm.
In the spiritual form, then all these animals have the power to give to you a gift. They have the ability to give you dreams. They have the ability to give you special powers that they can only do in spiritual form. So an animal cannot go from physical to spiritual back to physical. It's impossible.
Okay.
And the animal that I saw today, if I'm a member of the bear clan and I accidentally killed a bear during hunting, its spirit's probably going to be the one then that comes to me in spiritual form from then on out, because I've done something wrong and it's going to teach me some lessons throughout my life. But generally, the spiritual form of an animal isn't going to be an animal that you saw during your lifetime. So it's a grandfather. It's an older spirit that has moved on a long time ago that's trying to impart some sort of wisdom to you. And so it's kind of like the human concept of spirits that a lot of people believe that their grandparents give them guidance. So it's
right.
The same thing. You gave me guidance when I was alive, but now in the spiritual form, you're giving me a different kind of guidance.
Mm.
And so Hairy Man has that same ability, that he, in spiritual form, can come to people that you belong to him. So Hairy Man is going to come to a bear clan member and give them information. You have to be a part of who he is, and he be not. I don't like that word power animal, because that's actually a you know, new age type term that isn't accurate of what
right.
they are. But you know, you belong to him in that special sense, and so he will bring dreams to you. He'll tell you when things are wrong, and there is the ability that, say, you're out in the woods and you're about ready to go over a cliff, and you're too stupid to realize it. That animal can briefly appear to direct your attention or to keep you out of harm's way. You know, he'll direct you away from that harm and then go away. But I've never been under the impression that Native Americans can't tell the difference between when he's physical and when he's spiritual.
Okay.
And so if the spiritual being appears, you are well aware that it's the spiritual one, because he has a different kind of appearance to him. Versus a physical one, my impression has always been that they, you know, they don't pay any attention to you. They're doing their own thing. They're doing something like looking for food that a spiritual being wouldn't need to do. And the spiritual being, when they appear, they're only doing that to tell you something, to give you something, and you better be paying attention. And he'll make sure that he has your attention in order to impart that. But most of the time, the spiritual beings, even be it woodpecker, be it mountain lion, be it bear, appear to you during ceremonies or in dreams. It's fairly unusual that you're walking along and you see a spirit bear or a spirit wolf. It's pretty unusual.
So these aren't necessarily animals that can just, they're not, you're, what you're not saying here that animals just sort of like appear and disappear or become spiritual or turn into other animals or something like that. There's rules around this stuff.
There's rules that go with it. So, like I said, a Bigfoot or a wolf or eagle can't go from physical to spirit back to physical. There's no ability for them to do that. They can't transform themselves. There's no door or anything that they can come in and out of in that form.
Mm-hmm.
That when they talk about doors, they're talking about that the Bigfoot can come through the spirit door into our world and then back, but he's still spirit throughout the entire thing. He has no physical form. You can't reach out and touch him.
I see.
And he can't be solid. He can't, you know, change and fool you that he's something else. And nor do they have the ability to change into another animal. So a physical Bigfoot can't morph into a wolf or into something else and then turn back into a Bigfoot later. He does not have that ability. In his physical form, he's just an animal. He doesn't have anything else special that's about him other than the belief that he doesn't necessarily interact with humans all that well.
Right.
Lots of stories have him as in physical form is that he's a cannibal, that he will seek out human flesh in order to eat it. And that's a belief still pretty prominent in most tribes, that given the opportunity, he will definitely take advantage of it. And that's a physical form being.
Are there tribes Are there tribes that have stories where this Bigfoot type creature is both something to be afraid of and something to look for or to view as a good omen or something?
Oh yeah, there's what I'm finding is it's actually sometimes it can get very confusing, but there are definitely many tribes that have a good Bigfoot and a bad Bigfoot.
Hmm.
And the good Bigfoot has a completely different name, and he's pretty much just an animal that you encounter, and he plays tricks on you. He'll throw rocks, and he likes to throw his voice and scream, and he shakes trees, and he breaks trees, and he does stuff like that, just regular animal. And then a completely different Bigfoot that has a name that generally means cannibal or ogre or something to that effect, that is just a horrible being that will seek you down, hunt you down, take your children, steal them. A lot of times there's stories that he'll take women and keep them prisoner. They'll take children sometimes and keep them prisoner and not eat them, but try to raise them as their own. And they're definitely, you have to use the two different names for them. And when we were in Idaho, I think you remember that the Shoshone actually discussed that they have a name for a man-eater and then another name for the physical,
right,
the more kind of animal-type behavior. And I think that may just be different personalities that you're seeing in a Bigfoot community, of course, that you're going to have some that are just like humans that are better than others.
Right. I'm curious, your work, obviously you're very public with what you're doing here. You're speaking at different events and you've written things that have shown up online and of course, you know, in your very first anthropology class, you said why you were there basically. How are you viewed by your peers? Have you ever experienced any issues with this, or is it not that big of a deal?
No, I haven't. Usually what happens is, I'm a lot more open now than I was originally because I didn't know enough, and I was always fearful that somebody would ask me a question. I'd go, I don't know. So until I felt more comfortable that I could discuss it on a more intelligent level, I really wasn't all that open. But nowadays, people go, usually the reaction I get is, wow, you're really smart. There must be something more to this than I think. And
right.
And that's generally the reaction that I get. And the only bad reaction I ever got was when I was going for my master's degree at Cal State Bakersfield. We were doing a Bigfoot section in anthropology, physical anthropology. You always have, you know, one or two pages that have that topic in there. And I was the teacher's assistant in that class. And I said, well, you know, we really shouldn't just gloss this over. We really should put a little more effort into it. And, boy, I tell you what, that didn't go over very well. I was really kind of put in my place with that. And that's the only time that's ever happened. Other than that, most of the time people just go, oh, you know, you're not stupid. You know, so why don't you tell me a little more about this, and I'll direct them to websites or different information. And it goes over pretty well. And, you know, I have little Bigfoot things all over my desk. My screensaver's a Bigfoot. My mouth pad's a Bigfoot. I wear Bigfoot T-shirts out in the field. And I usually feel it makes people feel more relaxed about talking. And it's not uncommon that, you know, somebody goes, well, my dad was a logger back in the 1920s, and he saw this.
Right.
The tribe just loves it. They're always coming and telling me different things about nothing recent, though. That's what I'm always looking for is, what's the most recent stuff? Most of the stuff I get is from the 70s. But, you know, just I got a Bigfoot story yesterday when I was out of the tribe, and it's not uncommon. So,
do you have anybody? Because you're working in the Forest Service office most of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anybody just sort of wander in? And do people ask about this, or do people sort of like run in all out of breath saying, "I just saw a giant hairy thing," or anything like that?
No, I wish. I wish. That, no, that's never happened to me. But I do have. There's plenty of people who know what I do, and so when somebody from the public tells them stories, they make sure I get those stories. I've never had a member of the public come into the main supervisor's office and do that, because we're all the way down in Sonora. Now, up higher, when, you know, we have the mountain offices,
sure,
that are at where the campgrounds and stuff are, they do have stuff.
Okay, I see. So you're not really near all that stuff anyway.
But by the time you're down in Sonora, you're just thinking about going home. So
yeah, they've stopping really at the McDonald's or whatever. Yeah, okay.
But we did have one of the better stories that I've ever heard was a wildlife biologist who worked for the Forest Service who saw one, and he came right back in the office and he said, "I just saw this," and just was so overwhelmed he didn't even know what to think. And he told his boss and he told everybody that was in the office what had just happened. And that's a guy who's got a degree in wildlife biology. He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, so it wasn't a bear walking around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that you're involved with is the Alliance of Independent Bigfoot Researchers.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the AIBR.
Okay. Well, I'm currently the chair, and what we are is we're the only nonprofit Bigfoot research group there is, so people can donate and write it off their taxes. So that's the biggest benefit that we have over other groups, of course. But we're also different because everything we do is by majority vote. There's no dictators. Nobody is singly in charge at all. And we were formed because most of us are members, we're prior members of the BFRO or other groups that were just totally dissatisfied that we had no say in anything that happened, and we couldn't use, you know, we have this wonderful database called FLATS that we couldn't get any information out of. You can put information in, but you couldn't ever analyze the data. And plus, we weren't particularly pleased with people who have more of a paranormal bent to their beliefs, and so they were putting in reports that we just didn't feel were scientifically valid.
Right.
It was tainting the data that was in the database. And so we got together and formed this group, and it was meant to be just a group of individuals who were going to vote on everything. So we have a board of directors. We have elections every year. We have, you know, terms on the board. In fact, we have new elections coming up in November. Any member that's of the AIBR can be elected into the board of directors. And then the board of directors elects 5 members to do the day-to-day operations. And so that's what I'm the chair of, is I'm making sure that things are running on a smooth basis, generally, daily. We also have something called the Board of Advisors, and that would be people like Dr. Meldrum, John Green, Jimmy Chilcutt, lots of very high-quality people, Owen Caddy, Ricknell, who keep us on the straight and narrow. They look at the stuff that is on our website and tell us, you know, I really don't think that's appropriate. It's not scientific. They look at our protocols that we have on there, and we've altered them based on their input, things like that. And they're making sure that we're not doing anything that is for profit. They're making sure that we're presenting ourselves always in a scientific way. And what we're designed to do is to provide, instead of, there's lots of websites out there that cater to the public. We're here to cater to the researcher. We want people to try to do their research in a more consistent manner. And so we have protocols. We wish you would follow them. You don't have to. But it's, how do you collect evidence? How do you put bait out there in order to do this kind of research? If you're going to call blast, here are some good things to use to call blast. Right. If you think you've heard something out here, here is an entire database of different kinds of sounds like coyotes and wolves and elk that you can listen to so that you're prepared to hear something out there and not assume it is a Bigfoot. Different things like that. And then if you do hear something or you do find something, here are the scientists that can analyze it for you so that you aren't going on the BFF or whatever and saying, oh, I got this,
yeah.
when it's really just a coyote print or whatever. We can help you in advance of that. And we're only here to further the cause of scientific research of this animal. We're not here to make a profit or to try to get you, you know, a video sold to a newspaper outlet. We're not. That's not what we're about. But we are for the researcher. We do like the public to submit reports so that we know you can get more knowledge on the area that you're researching and try to find the hottest spot that you're at. But the design of us is for the researcher, and what we're hopefully going to eventually blossom into is this kind of umbrella organization where we have regional groups that are underneath us. So like a California group or a Texas group, and we have some of that already, that where a Texas report comes in, it goes right to the Texas report. The Texas website, they do the report, they do the investigation. It's published on their site, and then it's linked back to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide some consistency within the Bigfoot community of being scientific and being right on. And then if somebody is unethical, then we have the ability to say, you know, you did something completely wrong. And then, you know, a kind of a sanctioning method of trying to get people to stop doing some of the crap that they're doing out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big difference between you guys and other organizations is that it's sort of up to one person and sort of the mood they're in that day. You know, if something will be encouraged or tolerated or whatever, where you guys have more of a...
you're in or out based on a whim.
Right, right. And
yeah,
you and you just sort of wake up one day and find yourself unable to access the website or something, and that's how you find out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because you said something wrong, and you don't even know.
Right.
And that's fine. You know, that's their group. They can do whatever they want to. But we wanted the best of the best doing real research and not having any kind of fear that they don't have any say or there's an outcome for what you say. You do what is right. You vote on whatever's up for vote, and you feel good, even maybe your opinion didn't sway or whatever. Maybe you were the one person who voted against it, but at least you had your say.
Yeah, sure. How long has the AIBR been around?
Well, we've been around nearly a year. Our first set of elections were in November of 2005, and we got our nonprofit status like December 3rd of 2005.
Okay.
So we're getting up to our year anniversary. But prior to that, we had been trying to form and get organized. I'm losing track of time. Probably a good 6 months prior to that.
Okay.
Where we were trying to get organized and trying to, and there were various people who came and went from there. Like there were some SRI members at the time, members now that were part of that group that we weren't really getting ourselves together and got impatient with us and left
and took off. Yeah.
Formed something good on their side. You know, they wanted something different and they were able to, you know, have a different vision, which I think is wonderful. And I think it's actually a really good test to see what really works. You know, a dictator over here, kind of a non-organization where, you know, there isn't really any leadership, but they vote on everything as well, versus us who have some leadership, but it's a voted leadership role. And we'll see what works well.
Do you know how many members you have now in the AIBR?
I don't know, somewhere around 50.
Okay.
That are actual members, and we have members that are on a different category that's probably somewhere around 200.
Okay.
So, I don't actually know.
What's
let me think up for vote right now, so I don't know.
So you're almost a year old. Obviously, you're still sort of in your formative stage here. What are the hardest things that you've found in sort of pulling this thing together so far? What are the biggest challenges?
The biggest challenges is getting out there, getting what the AIBR is onto the web, in the sense of getting the hits, getting people to come. And, you know, we do get reports. We have an 800 number that people can call if they don't have a computer, and we're steadily getting, you know, flyers and other advertisement out there so they know we're here. But it is tough because you have some well-established groups that are out mm-hmm. there that have been there for a very long time, that people, when they put in the word Bigfoot, that's what comes up first. And so it'll take time. And, of course, they've been around for 10 years plus, so that's fair enough. So that's the hardest part, is getting getting it out there that we exist and that we provide something different than what other groups currently are providing.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for taking the time to talk to me today.
Oh, no problem.
It's been a lot of fun. So there you have it. BIPcast number one is, as some people say, in the can. Remember, if you have any comments or questions about today's show or any other show, visit BigfootForums.com and join in the conversation there. Also, I neglected to say up front that there's also a phone number you can call to leave a comment or a question for future guests. That's 612-246-4690, area code 612-246-4690, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call that number and leave a message. So that's it. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Well, I want to thank you a lot for taking the time to talk to me today.
No problem.
It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, good. Well, edit that so it sounds good.